stare from his brother and a sour smile from the consul. Gabriel realized he had no idea if the consul himself had a family or children. He was just the consul.
"You boys have any idea," he said, "what kind of peril you're in?"
"Peril? From who? Charlotte?" Gideon sounded incredulous.
"Not from Charlotte,"
the consul returned his gaze to them.
"Your father did not just break the law. He blasphemed it. He did not just deal with demons. He lay down among them. You are the Lightwoods. You are all that is left of the Lightwoods. You have no cousins, no aunts and uncles. I could have your whole family stricken off the registers of the Nephilim, and turn you and your sister out into the street to starve, or beg a living amid the mundanes. And I would be within the rights of the Clave and Council to do it. And who do you think would stand up for you? Who would speak in your defense?"
Gideon had gone very pale, and his knuckles, where he gripped Gabriel's arm, were white. "That is not fair," he said. "We did not know. My brother trusted my father. He cannot be held responsible."
"Trusted him? He delivered the death blow, didn't he?"
said the consul.
"Oh, you all contributed. But his was the coup de grace that slew your father, which rather indicates that he knew exactly what your father was."
Gabriel was aware of Gideon looking at him with concern. The air in the Argent's room was hot and close, stealing his breath. The woman on stage was now singing a song called "All Through Obliging a Lady," and striding up and down, hitting the stage over and over with the end of a walking stick, which made the floor shudder.
"The sins of the fathers, children. You can and you will be punished for his crimes if I desire it. What will you do, Gideon, while your brother and Tatiana have their runes burned off? Will you stand and watch?"
Gabriel's right hand twitched. He felt sure he would have reached out and seized the consul by the throat if Gideon hadn't caught hold of him first and held his wrist.
"What do you want from us?" Gideon asked, his voice controlled. "You didn't bring us here to threaten us, not unless you want something in return.
And if it was something you could ask easily or legally, you would have done it in the Silent City."
"Clever boy," the consul said. "I want you to do something for me. Do it, and I will see to it that though the Lightwood House may be confiscated, you retain your honor and your name, your lands in Idris, and your place as Shadow Hunters."
"What do you want us to do?"
"I wish you to observe Charlotte, most specifically her correspondence. Tell me what letters she receives and sends, especially to and from Idris."
"You want us to spy on her?" Gideon's voice was flat.
"I do not want any more surprises like the one about your father," said the consul. "She should never have kept his disease a secret from me."
"She had to," Gideon said. "It was a condition of the agreement they made." The consul's lips tightened.
"Charlotte Branwell has no right to make agreements of such scope without consulting me. I am her superior. She should not and cannot go over my head in that manner. She and that group in the Institute behave as if they are their own country that exists under its own laws. Look what happened to Jessamine Lovelace. She betrayed us all, nearly to our destruction. James Carstairs is a dying drug addict. That grey girl is a changeling or a warlock and has no place in an Institute. Ridiculous engagement be damned. And Will Herondale. Will Herondale is a liar and a spoilt brat who will grow up to be a criminal if he grows up at all."
The consul paused, breathing hard.
"Charlotte may run that place like a fiefdom, but it is not. It is an Institute and it reports to the consul. And so will you."
"Charlotte has done nothing to deserve such a betrayal from me," Gideon said. The consul jabbed a finger toward him.
"That is exactly what I speak of. Your loyalty is not to her. It cannot be to her. It is to me. It must be to me. Do you understand that?"
"And if I say no?"
"Then you lose everything. House, land, name, lineage, purpose."
"We'll do it," said Gabriel, before Gideon could speak again. "We will watch her for you."
"Gabriel,"
Gideon began. Gabriel turned on his brother. "No," he said, It's too much. You don't want to be a liar, I understand that. But our first loyalty is to family. The Blackthorns would throw Tatty out on the streets, and she wouldn't last a moment there, her and the child. Gideon whitened. Tatiana's going to have a child. Despite the horror of the situation, Gabriel felt a flash of satisfaction at knowing something his brother hadn't known. Yes, he said. You would have known it if you were still part of our family. Gideon glanced around the room as if searching for a familiar face, then looked helplessly back at his brother and the consul.
I...
Consul Whalen smiled coldly at Gabriel, and then his brother.
Have we an agreement, gentlemen?
After a long moment, Gideon nodded. We will do it. Gabriel would not soon forget the look that spread over the consul's face at that. There was satisfaction in it, but there was little surprise. It was clear he had expected nothing else, and nothing better, from the Lightwood boys.
Scones? Tessa said incredulously. Sophie's mouth twitched into a smile. She was down on her knees before the grate with a rag and a bucket of soapy water.
You could have knocked me into a cocked hat, I was that startled, she confirmed. Dozens of scones under his bed, all gone as hard as rocks.
My goodness, Tessa said, sliding to the edge of the bed and leaning back on her hands. Whenever Sophie was in her room cleaning, Tessa always had to hold herself back from rushing over to help the other girl with a tinderbox or the dusting. She'd tried it on a few occasions, but after Sophie had set Tessa down gently but firmly for the fourth time, she'd given it up.
And you were angry? Tessa said.
Course I was. Making all that extra work for me, carrying the scones up and down the stairs, and then hiding them like that. I shouldn't be surprised if we end the autumn with mice.
Tessa nodded, gravely acknowledging the potential rodent issue. But isn't it a bit flattering that he went to such lengths just to see you?
Sophie sat up straight. It's not flattering. He's not thinking. He's a shadow hunter, and I'm a mundane. I can expect nothing from him. In the best of all possible worlds, he may offer to take me as a mistress while he marries a shadow hunter girl.
Tessa's throat tightened, remembering Will on the roof offering her just that. Offering her shame and disgrace, and how small she had felt, how worthless. It had been a lie, but the memory still held pain.
No, Sophie said, looking back down at her red, work-roughened hands. It's better that I never entertain the idea. That way there'll be no disappointment.
I think the Lightwoods are better men than that, Tessa offered.
Sophie brushed her hair back from her face, her fingers lightly touching the scar that bisected her cheek. Sometimes, I think there are no better men than that.
Neither Gideon nor Gabriel spoke as their carriage rattled back through the streets of the West End to the Institute. The rain was pouring down now, rattling the carriage so noisily that Gabriel doubted anyone would have heard him if he had spoken. Gideon was studying his shoes, and did not look up as they rolled back to the Institute. As it loomed up out of the rain, the consul reached across Gabriel and opened the door for them to exit.
I trust you boys, he said. I'll go make Charlotte trust you too, and tell no one of our discussion. As far as this afternoon is concerned, you spent it with the brothers.
Gideon climbed down out of the carriage without another word, and Gabriel followed him. The landau swung around and rattled off into the grey London afternoon. The sky was black and yellow, the drizzle as heavy as lead pellets, the fog so thick that Gabriel could barely see the Institute gates as they swung shut behind the carriage. He certainly didn't see his brother's hands as they darted forward, seized him by the collar of his jacket, and dragged him halfway around the side of the Institute. He nearly fell as Gideon pushed him up against the stone wall of the old church. They were near the stables, half hidden from view by one of the buttresses, but not protected from the rain. Cold drops assaulted Gabriel's head and neck and slid into his shirt.
Gideon!
He protested, slipping on the muddy flagstones.
Be quiet.
Gideon's eyes were huge and grey in the dull light, barely tinged with green.
You're right, Gabriel dropped his voice. We should organize our story. When they ask us what we did this afternoon, we must be in perfect accord in our answer, or it will not be believable.
I said be quiet!
Gideon slammed his brother's shoulders back against the wall, hard enough for Gabriel to let out a gasp of pain.
We are not going to tell Charlotte our conversation with the consul.
but neither are we going to spy on her. Gabriel, you are my brother, and I love you. I would do anything to protect you, but I will not sell out your soul and mine. Gabriel looked at his brother. Rain soaked Gideon's hair and dripped into the collar of his coat. We could die on the street if we refuse to do what the consul says. I'm not going to lie to Charlotte, said Gideon.
Gideon!
Did you see the look on the consul's face, Gideon interrupted, when we agreed to spy for him, to betray the generosity of the house that hosts us? He was not in the least surprised. He never had a moment's doubt about us. He expects nothing but treachery from Lightwoods. That is our birthright. His hands tightened on Gabriel's arms. There is more to life than surviving, he said. We have honor. We are Nephilim. If he takes that, we truly have nothing. Why? Gabriel asked. Why are you so sure that Charlotte's side is the right one?
Because our father's was not, said Gideon. Because I know Charlotte. Because I have lived among these people for months and they are good people. Because Charlotte Bramwell has been nothing but kind to me, and Sophie loves her.
And you love Sophie? Gideon's mouth tensed. She's a mundane and a servant, said Gabriel. And I don't know what you expect to come of it, Gideon.
Nothing, Gideon said roughly. I expect nothing.
But the fact that you believe I should shows that our father brought us up to believe that we should do right only if some reward was the result.
I will not betray the word I have given Charlotte. That is the situation, Gabriel. If you do not want a part of it, I will send you to live with Tatiana and the Blackthorns. I am sure they will take you in. But I will not lie to Charlotte.
Yes, you will, said Gabriel. We are both going to lie to Charlotte, but we are going to lie to the consul, too.
Gideon narrowed his eyes. Rainwater dripped off his eyelashes.
What do you mean?
We will do as the consul says and read Charlotte's correspondence. Then we will report to him, but the reports will be false.
If we are going to give him false reports anyway, why read her correspondence?
To know what not to say, Gabriel said, tasting dampness in his mouth. It tasted as if it had dripped from the Institute roof, bitter and dirty.
To avoid accidentally telling him the truth.
If we are discovered, we could face consequences of the utmost severity.
Gabriel spit rainwater.
Then you tell me, would you risk severe consequences for the inhabitants of the Institute or not? Because I am doing this for you, and because...
Because?
Because I made a mistake. I was wrong about our father. I believed in him, and I should not have.
Gabriel took a deep breath.
I was wrong, and I seek to undo that, and if there is a price to be paid, then I will pay it.
Gideon looked at him for a long time.
Was that your plan all along?
When you agreed to the consul's demands in the Argent Rooms.
Was this your plan?
Gabriel looked away from his brother toward the rain-wet courtyard. In his mind he could see the two of them, much younger, standing where the Thames cut through the edge of the house's property, and Gideon showing the safe path through the swampy ground. His brother had always been the one to show him the safe paths. There had been a time when they had trusted each other implicitly, and he did not know when it had ended, but his heart ached for it more than it ached at the loss of his father.
"Would you believe me," he said bitterly, "if I told you it was? Because it is the truth."
Gideon was still for a long moment. Then Gabriel found himself hauled forward, his face mashed into the wet wool of Gideon's overcoat, while his brother held him tightly, murmuring,
"All right, little brother. It's going to be all right,"
as he rocked them back and forth in the rain.
2. Members of the Council. From Consul Josiah Wayland. Very well, gentlemen. In that case, I ask only for your patience and that you not act in haste. If it is proof you want, I will furnish proof. I shall write again on this subject soon. In Razil's name, and in defense of his honor, Consul Josiah Wayland.
Chapter 7. Dare to Wish. If the past year were offered me again, and choice of good and ill before me set, would I accept the pleasure with the pain, or dare to wish that we had never met? Augusta, Lady Gregory, if the past year were offered me again.
To Consul Wayland, from Gabriel and Gideon Lightwood. Dear Sir, we are most thankful that you have assigned us the task of monitoring Mrs. Branwell's behaviour. Women, as we know, need to be closely watched so they do not go astray. We are grieved to announce that we have shocking tidings to report. A woman's management of our household is her most important duty, and one of the most important womanly virtues is frugality. Mrs. Branwell, however, seems addicted to expenditure and cares for nothing save vulgar display. Though she may be dressed plainly when you pay a visit, we are saddened to report that in her leisure hours she bedecks herself with the finest silks and most costly jewels imaginable. You asked us to, and loath though we were to invade a lady's privacy, we did so. We would report the exact details of her letter to her modiste, but we fear you would be overcome. Suffice it to say, the money outlaid upon hats rivals the annual income of a large estate or a small country. We fail to see why one small woman needs so many hats. She is unlikely to be concealing additional heads upon her person. We will be too gentlemanly to comment upon a lady's attire, except for the deleterious effect it has on our duties. She skimps on household necessities to the most horrifying degree. Every night we sit down to a dinner of gruel, as she sits at table dripping with gems and gewgaws. This is, you may conceive, hardly fighting fair for your valiant shadow hunters. We are so weak that we were almost vanquished by a behemoth demon last Tuesday, and of course those creatures are chiefly composed of a viscous substance. At our peak and sustained with good victuals, either of us would be capable of crushing beneath our boot heels a dozen behemoth demons at a time. We very much hope that you will be able to render us assistance in this matter, and that Mrs. Branwell's outlay upon hats and other feminine articles of clothing that we hesitate in delicacy to name will be checked. Yours truly, Gideon and Gabriel Lightwood.
What's a gewgaw?
Gabriel asked, blinking owlishly down at the epistle he had just helped compose. Actually, Gideon had dictated most of it. Gabriel had merely moved the pen across the page. He was beginning to suspect that behind his brother's dour facade lay an unsung comic genius. Gideon waved a dismissive hand. It doesn't matter. Seal the envelope and let us give it to Cyril that it may go out with the morning post. It had been several days since the battle with the great worm, and Cecily was in the training room again. She was beginning to wonder if she should simply move her bed and other furnishings into this space, as she seemed to spend most of her time here. The bedroom Charlotte had given her was nearly bare of decoration or anything that might remind her of home. She had brought almost nothing personal with her from Wales, not expecting that she would be staying for a lengthy time. Here, at least in the weapons room, she felt secure. Perhaps because there was no room like it where she had grown up. It was purely a shadow hunter place. Nothing about it could possibly make her homesick. The walls were hung with dozens of weapons. Her first lesson with Will, when he had still been blazing with rage that she was there at all, had involved memorizing all their names and what they did. Katana blades from Japan, double-handed broadswords, thin-bladed Mazera cords, morning stars and maces, curved Turkish blades, crossbows and slingshots, and tiny pipes that blew poisoned needles. She remembered him spitting out the words as if they were poison.
"Be as angry as you want, big brother," she had thought. "I may pretend I wish to be a shadow hunter now, because it gives you no choice but to keep me here. But I will show you that these people are not your family. I will bring you home." She lifted a sword from the wall now and balanced it carefully in her hands. Will had explained to her that the way to hold a two-handed sword was just below the ribcage, pointing straight out. Legs should be balanced with equal weight on them, and the sword should be swung from the shoulders, not the arms, to get the most force in a killing blow. A killing blow. For so many years she had been angry at her brother for leaving them all to join the shadow hunters in London, for giving himself up to what her mother had termed a life of mindless murder, of weapons and blood and death. What was so poor to him about the Green Mountains of Wales? What did their family lack? Why turn your back on the bluest of blue seas for something as empty as all that? And yet here she was, choosing to spend her time alone in the training room with a silent collection of weaponry. The weight of the sword in her hand was comforting, almost as if it served as a barrier between herself and her feelings. She and Will had wandered all over the city a few nights before, from opium dens to gambling hells to ifrit haunts, a blur of color and sense and light. He had not been exactly friendly, but she knew that for Will, allowing her to accompany him on such a sensitive errand had been a gesture indeed. She had enjoyed their companionship that night. It had been like having her brother back. But as the evening had worn on, Will had become progressively more silent, and when they returned to the Institute, he had stalked away, clearly wishing to be alone, leaving Cecily with nothing to do but return to her room and lie awake staring at the ceiling until dawn came. She had thought somehow, when she had planned to come here, that the bonds that held him here could not be that strong. His attachment to these people could not be like his attachment to family. But as the night had gone on, and she had seen his hope and then his disappointment at each new establishment when he'd asked for Yin Fen and there was none to be had, she had understood. Oh, she had been told it before, and known it before, but that was not the same as understanding, that the ties that bound him here were as strong as any ties of blood. She was tired now, and though she gripped the sword as Will had taught her, right hand below the guard, left hand on the pommel, it slipped from her grasp and tipped forward, burying itself point down in the floor. "Oh dear," said a voice from the doorway. "I'm afraid I could only give that effort a 3. 4, perhaps, if I were inclined to give you an extra point for practicing swordplay in an afternoon dress." Cecily, who indeed had not bothered to change into gear, flung her head back and glared at Gabriel Lightwood, who had appeared in the doorway like some sort of imp of the perverse. "Perhaps I'm not interested in your opinion, sir." "Perhaps." He took a step forward into the room. "The angel knows your brother never has been." "In that we are united," Cecily remarked, pulling the sword free of the floor. "But not in much else." Gabriel moved to stand behind her. They were both reflected in one of the training mirrors. Gabriel was a good head taller than her, and she could see his face clearly over her shoulder. He had one of those odd, sharp-boned faces, handsome from some angles and peculiarly interesting-looking from others. There was a small white scar on his chin as if he had been nicked there by a thin blade. "Would you like me to show you how to properly hold the sword?" "If you must." He did not reply, but reaching around her, adjusted her grip on the pommel. "You never want to hold the sword point down," he said. "Hold it like this, point out, so that if your opponent charges you, they will skewer themselves on your blade." Cecily adjusted her grip accordingly. Her mind was racing. She had thought of shadow hunters as monsters for such a long time. Monsters who had kidnapped her brother, and she a heroine riding up to rescue him even if he didn't realize he needed rescuing. It had been strange and gradual, realizing how human they were. She could feel the warmth rising from Gabriel's body, his breath stirring her hair, and oh, it was odd to be conscious of so many things about someone else. The way they felt, the brush of their skin, the way they smelled. "I saw the way you fought at Lightwood House," Gabriel Lightwood murmured. His calloused hand brushed down over her fingers, and Cecily fought back a small shiver. "Badly," she said, attempting a teasing tone. "With passion. There are those who fight because it is their duty, and those who fight because they love it. You love it." "I don't," Cecily began, but she was interrupted as the training room door flew open with a loud bang. It was Will, filling the doorway with his lanky, broad-shouldered frame. His blue eyes were thunderous. "What are you doing here?" he demanded. So much for the brief peace they had achieved the night before. "I am practicing," Cecily said. "You told me I would get no better without practice." "Not you. Gabriel Lightworm over here." Will jerked his chin toward the other boy. "Sorry, Lightwood." Gabriel slowly unhitched his arms from around Cecily. "Whoever has been tutoring your sister in swordplay has imparted many bad habits. I was merely endeavouring to help." "I told him it was all right," Cecily said, having no idea why she was defending Gabriel, except that she suspected it would annoy Will. "It did." His eyes narrowed. "And did he tell you
He'd been looking for years for a way to get back at me for what he perceives as an insult to his sister. And what better way of doing it than through you? Cecily whipped her head around to stare at Gabriel, who wore an expression of mixed annoyance and defiance. Is that true? He did not reply to her, but to Will. If we are going to live in the same house, Herondale, then we shall have to learn to treat each other cordially. Don't you agree? As long as I can still break your arm as easily as to look at you, I agree to no such thing. Will reached up and plucked her rapier off the wall. Now get out of here, Gabriel, and leave my sister alone. With a scornful look, Gabriel pushed his way past Will and out of the room. Was that absolutely necessary, Will? Cecily demanded, as soon as the door had shut behind him. I know Gabriel Lightwood, and you do not. I suggest you leave it to me to be the best judge of his character. He wishes to use you to hurt me. Really, you cannot imagine a motivation he might have that is not yourself. I know him, Will said again. He has shown himself to be a liar and a traitor. People change? Not that much. You have? Cecily said, striding across the room and dropping her sword onto a bench with a clatter. So have you, Will said, surprising her. She turned on him. I have changed. How have I changed? When you came here, he said, you spoke over and over of getting me to come home with you. You disliked your training. You pretended otherwise, but I could tell. Then it ceased to be, Will, you must go home, and became, write a letter, Will. And you began enjoying your training. Gabriel Lightwood is a bounder, but he was right about one thing. You did enjoy fighting the Great Worm at Lightwood House. Shadow Hunter blood is like gunpowder in your veins, Sissy. Once it is lit, it is not so easily extinguished. Remain much longer here, and there is every likelihood that you'll be like me. Too entwined to leave. Cecily squinted at her brother. His shirt was open at the collar, showing something scarlet winking in the hollow of his throat. Are you wearing a woman's necklace, Will? Will put his hand onto his neck with a startled look, but before he could respond, the door to the training room opened once more and Sophie stood there, an anxious expression upon her scarred face. Master Will, Miss Herondale, she said, I've been looking for you. Charlotte has requested that everyone come to the drawing room right away. It is a matter of some urgency. Cecily had always been something of a lonely child. It was difficult not to be when your older siblings were dead or missing, and there were no young people your age nearby whom your parents considered suitable companions. She had learned early to amuse herself with her own observations of people, unshared with others, but kept close that she might take them out later and examine them when she was in solitude. The habits of a lifetime were not broken quickly, and though Cecily was no longer lonely, since she had come to the Institute 8 weeks ago, she had made its inhabitants the subjects of her close study. They were shadow hunters after all, the enemy at first, and then, as that had become less and less her view, simply the subject of fascination. She examined them now as she walked into the drawing room beside Will. First was Charlotte, seated behind her desk. Cecily had not known Charlotte long, and yet she knew that Charlotte was the sort of woman who kept her calm even under pressure. She was tiny but strong, a bit like Cecily's own mother, although with less of a penchant for muttering in Welsh. Then there was Henry. He might have been the first of them all to convince Cecily that those shadow hunters were different, they were not dangerously alien. There was nothing frightening about Henry, all lanky legs and angles as he leaned against Charlotte's desk. Her eyes slid over Gideon Lightwood next, shorter and stockier than his brother. Gideon, whose green-grey eyes usually followed Sophie about the Institute like a hopeful puppy's. She wondered if the others in the Institute had noticed his attachment to their maid and what Sophie thought about it herself. And then there was Gabriel. Cecily's thoughts, where he was concerned, were jumbled and confused. His eyes were bright, his body tense as a coiled spring as he leaned against his brother's armchair. On the dark velvet sofa just across from the Lightwoods sat Jem with Tessa behind him. He had looked up as the door had opened, and, as he always did, had seemed to glow a little brighter when he saw Will. It was a quality peculiar to both of them, and Cecily wondered if it was that way for all Parabatai, or if they were a unique case. In either eventuality, it must be terrifying to be so intertwined with another person.
especially when one of them is as fragile as Jem. As she watched, Tessa laid her hand over Jem's and said something quiet to him that made him smile. Tessa looked quickly to Will, but he only crossed the room as he always did to lean against the fireplace mantel. Cecily had never been able to decide if he did this because he was perpetually cold or because he thought he looked dashing standing before the leaping flames.
You must be ashamed of your brother, harbouring illicit feelings for his parabatized fiancée, Will had said to her.
If he'd been anyone else, she would have told him there was no point keeping secrets. The truth would out, eventually. But in Will's case, she was not so sure. He had the skill of years of hiding and pretending on his side. He was a master actor. If it were not that she was his sister, if it were not that she saw his face at the moments when Jem was not looking, she did not think that she would have guessed it either. And then there was the awful truth that he would not need to hide his secret forever. He needed to hide it only as long as Jem lived. If James Carstairs were not so unrelentingly kind and well-intentioned, Cecily thought, she might have hated him on her brother's behalf. Not only was he marrying the girl Will loved, but when he himself died, she feared, Will would never recover. But you could not blame someone for dying. For leaving on purpose, perhaps, as her brother had left her and her parents, but not for dying. The power over which was surely beyond the grasp of any mortal human. I'm glad you're all here, Charlotte said in a strained voice that snapped Cecily out of her brown study. Charlotte was looking gravely down at a polished salver on her desk, on which was an open letter and a small packet wrapped in waxed paper. I have received a disturbing piece of correspondence. From the Magister.
From Mortmain?
Tessa leaned forward, and the clockwork angel she always wore around her neck swung free, glittering in the light from the fire.
He wrote to you?
Not to inquire about your health, one presumes, said Will.
What does he want? Charlotte took a deep breath. I will read you the letter.
My dear Mrs. Branwell, forgive me for troubling you at what must be a distressing time for your household. I was grieved, though I must confess not shocked, to hear of Mr. Carstairs' grave indisposition. I believe you are aware that I am the happy possessor of a large, I might say, exclusively large portion of the medicine that Mr. Carstairs requires for his continual well-being. Thus, we find ourselves in a most interesting situation, which I am eager to resolve to the satisfaction of us both. I would be very glad to make an exchange. If you are willing to confide Miss Grey to my keeping, I will place a large portion of Yin Fen in yours. I send a token of my goodwill. Pray, let me know of your decision by writing to me. If the correct sequence of numbers that are printed at the bottom of this letter are spoken to my automaton, I am sure to receive it. Yours sincerely, Axel Mortmain. That is all, Charlotte said, folding the letter in half and placing it back on the salver. There are instructions on how to summon the automaton to which he wishes us to give our answer, and there are the number he speaks of. But they give no clue to his location. There was a shocked silence. Cecily, who had seated herself in a small flowered armchair, glanced at Will and saw him look away as if to hide his expression. Jem paled, his face turning the colour of old ash, and Tessa sat very still, the light from the fire chasing shadows across her face. Mortmain wants me, she said finally, breaking the silence. In exchange for Jem's Yin Fen. It is ridiculous, Jem said. Untenable. The letters should be given to the Clave to see if they can discern anything about his location from it, but that is all. They will not be able to discern anything about his location from it, said Will quietly. The Magister has proved himself over and over too clever for that. That is not clever, said Jem. That is the crudest form of blackmail. I do not disagree, said Will. I say we take the packet as a blessing, a handful more of Yin Fen that will help you, and we ignore the rest.
Mortmain wrote the letter about me, Tessa said, interrupting them both. The decision should be mine.
She angled her body toward Charlotte.
I will go.
There was another dead silence. Charlotte looked ashen. Cecily could feel her own hands slippery with sweat where they twisted in her lap. The Lightwood brothers seemed desperately uncomfortable. Gabriel looked as if he wished he were anywhere else but there. Cecily could hardly blame them. The tension between Will, Jem, and Tessa felt like a powder keg that needed only a match to blow it to kingdom come.
No, Jem said finally, rising to his feet. Tessa, you cannot.
She followed his motion, rising as well.
I can. You're my fiancé. I cannot allow you to die when I might help you, and Mortmain does not mean me physical harm.
We do not know what he means. He cannot be trusted, Will said, and then he put his head down, his hand gripping the mantle so hard his fingers were white. Cecily could tell he was forcing himself to be silent.
If it were you Mortmain wanted, Will, you would go, Tessa said, looking at Cecily's brother with a meaning in her eyes that brooked no contradiction.
Will flinched at her words.
No, said Jem. I would forbid him as well.
Tessa turned to Jem with the first expression of anger toward him Cecily had ever seen on her face.
You cannot forbid me, any more than you could Will.
I can, Jem said, for a simple reason. The drug is not a cure, Tessa. It only extends my living. I will not allow you to throw away your own life for a remnant of mine. If you go to Mortmain, it will be for nothing. I still won't take the drug.
Will lifted his head.
James.
But Tessa and Jem were staring at each other, eyes locked.
You would not, Tessa breathed.
You would not insult me by hurling a sacrifice I made for you back in my face like that.
Jem strode across the room and seized the packet and the letter off Charlotte's desk.
I would rather insult you than lose you, he said, and before any of them could make a move to stop him, he cast both items into the fire.
The room erupted in shouts. Henry dashed forward, but Will had already dropped to his knees before the grate and thrust both his hands into the flames.
Cecily bolted out of her chair.
Will!
She shouted, and darted over to her brother. She seized him by the shoulder of his jacket and pulled him away from the fire. He tumbled backward, the still-burning packet falling from his hands. Gideon was there a moment later, stamping out the small flames with his feet, leaving a mess of burned paper and silvery powder on the rug.
Cecily stared into the grate.
The letter, with the instructions telling how to summon Mortmain's automaton, was gone, burned into ashes.
Will, Jem said.
He looked sick. He fell to his knees next to Cecily, still holding her brother's shoulders, and drew a steely from his jacket.
Will's hands were scarlet, livid white where blisters were already forming on the skin, and patched black with soot. His breath was hitching and harsh in Cecily's ear, gasps of pain, the way he had sounded when he had fallen off the roof of their house when he was 9 and had shattered the bones in his left arm.
Better genoeg, Will, she said, as Jem put the steely to her brother's forearm and drew quickly.
You'll be all right.
Will, Jem said under his breath.
Will, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Will. Will's hitching breaths were slowing as the Eratzi took effect, his skin paling back to its normal color.
There's still some Yinfen that can be preserved, Will said, slumping back against Cecily.
He smelled like smoke and iron. She could feel his heart pounding through his back.
It had better be gathered up before anything else.
Here, was Tessa, kneeling down. Cecily was dimly aware that all the others were standing, Charlotte with one hand over her mouth in shock. In Tessa's right hand was a handkerchief, in which was perhaps half a handful of Yinfen, all that Will had saved from the fire.
Take this, she said, and put it in Jem's free hand, the one that did not hold the steely.
He looked as if he were about to speak to her, but she had already straightened up, looking utterly shattered. Jem watched as she walked from the room.
Oh, Will. Whatever are we going to do with you?
Will sat, feeling rather incongruous in the flowered armchair in the drawing room, letting Charlotte, perched on a small stool before him, smear salve on his hands. They no longer hurt much,
After three Eratzes, they had returned to their normal color, but Charlotte insisted on treating them anyway. The others had gone, save for Cecily and Jem. Cecily sat beside him, perched on the arm of his chair, and Jem knelt on the burned rug, his feely in his hands, not touching Will, but close. They had refused to leave, even after the others had drifted away and Charlotte had sent Henry back to the cellar to work. There was nothing more to be done, after all. The instructions on how to contact Mortmain were gone, burned to ash, and there was no more decision to be made. Charlotte had insisted that Will stay and have his hands salved, and Cecily and Jem had refused to leave him. And Will had to admit he liked it, liked having his sister there on the arm of his chair, liked the fiercely protective glares she shot at anyone who came near him, even Charlotte, sweet and harmless with her salve and her motherly clucking. And Jem, at his feet, leaning a bit against his chair, as he had so many times when Will was being bandaged up from fights or a rat seed because of wounds he'd gotten in battle. "Do you remember the time Melion tried to knock your teeth out for calling him a pointy-eared layabout?" Jem said. He'd taken some of the yinfen Mortmain had sent, and there was colour in his cheeks again. Will smiled. Despite everything, he couldn't help it. It had been the one thing in the past few years that had made him feel fortunate, that he had someone in his life who knew him, knew what he was thinking before he said it out loud. "I would have knocked his teeth out in return," he said. "But when I went to find him again, he'd emigrated to America to avoid my wrath, no doubt." "Hmm," said Charlotte, the way she always did when she thought Will was getting above himself. "He had many enemies in London, to my understanding."
"Did we them a good bobpoy, you ingrio, inu bobor, erdikin shardam dano,"
said Cecily plaintively.
"You may not know who we are talking about, but no one else knows what you are saying," said Will, though his tone held no real reproof. He could hear the exhaustion in his own voice. The lack of sleep of the night before was taking its toll.
"Speak English, Ceci."
Charlotte rose, returned to her desk and set the jar of the salve down. Cecily tugged on a lock of Will's hair.
"Let me see your hands."
He held them up. He remembered the fire, the white-hot agony of it, and, more than anything else, Tessa's shocked face. He knew she would understand why he had done what he had done, why he had not thought twice about it, but the look in her eyes, as if her heart had broken for him. He only wished that she was still here. It was good to be here with Jem and Cecily and Charlotte, to be surrounded by their affection. But without her, there would always be something missing, a Tessa-shaped part chiseled out of his heart that he would never get back. Cecily touched his fingers, which looked quite normal now, aside from the soot under his fingernails.
"It's quite astonishing," she said,
then patted his hands, lightly, careful not to smear the salve.
"Will has always been prone to damaging himself," she added, with fondness in her tone. "I cannot count the broken limbs he sustained when we were children, the scratches, the scars."
Jem leaned closer against the chair, staring into the fire.
"Better it were my hands," he said.
Will shook his head. Exhaustion was muting the edges of everything in the room, blurring the flocked wallpaper into a single mass of dark colour.
"No. Not your hands. You need your hands for the violin. What do I need mine for?" "I should have known what you would do," Jem said in a low voice. "I always know what you will do. I should have known you would put your hands into the fire. And I should have known you would throw that packet away," said Will without rancor. It was a madly noble thing to do. I understand why you did it. I was thinking of Tessa."
Jem drew his knees up and rested his chin on them, and then laughed softly.
"Madly noble. Isn't that meant to be your area of expertise? Suddenly I'm the one who does ridiculous things, and you tell me to stop."
"God," said Will, "when did we change places?"
The firelight played over Jem's face and hair as he shook his head.
"It's a very strange thing to be in love," he said. "It changes you."
Will looked down at Jem, and what he felt, more than jealousy, more than anything else, was a wistful desire to commiserate with his best friend, to speak of the feelings he held in his heart. For were they not the same feelings? Did they not love the same way? The same person? But I wish you would not risk yourself, was all he said.
Jem stood up.
I've always wished that about you.
Will raised his eyes, so drowsy with sleep and the tiredness that came with healing wounds, that he could see Jem only as a haloed figure of light.
Are you going?
Yes, to sleep.
Jem touched his fingers lightly to Will's healing hands.
Let yourself rest, Will.
Will's eyes were already drifting closed, even as Jem turned to go. He did not hear the door close behind Jem. Somewhere down the corridor, Bridget was singing, her voice rising above the crackle of the fire. Will did not find it as annoying as he usually did, but rather more like a lullaby that his mother would once have sung to him to guide him to sleep.
Oh, what is brighter than the light? What is darker than the night? What is keener than an axe? What is softer than melting wax? Truth is brighter than the light. Falsehood darker than the night. Revenge is keener than an axe, and love is softer than melting wax.
A riddle song, Cicely said, her voice drowsy and half awake.
I've always liked those. Do you remember when Mam used to sing to us?
A little, Will admitted. If he were not so tired, he might not have omitted it at all. His mother had always been singing, music filling the corners of the manor house, singing while she walked beside the waters in the Malthic estuary, or among the daffodils in the gardens.
Saun no coi da thaila blota, saun no goria me ken vivine.
Do you remember the sea? He said, exhaustion making his voice heavy.
The lake at Talathlin. There is nothing so blue here in London as either of those things.
He heard Cecily take a sharp breath.
Of course I remember. I thought you did not.
Images from dreams painted themselves on the inside of Will's eyelids, sleep reaching for him like a current, pulling him away from the lighted shore.
I do not think I can get up out of this chair, Ceci, he murmured. I shall rest here tonight.
Her hand came up, felt for his, and circled it in a loose clasp.
Then I will stay with you, she said,
and her voice became part of the current of dreams and sleep that caught him finally and drew him down and over and under.
2. Gabriel and Gideon Lightwood, from Consul Josiah Wayland. I was most surprised to receive your missive. I failed to perceive how I could possibly have made myself more clear. I wish for you to relay the details of Mrs. Branwell's correspondence with her relatives and well-wishers in Idris. I did not request any persiflage about the woman's milliner. I do not care about her manner of dress, nor about your daily menu. Pray, write back to me a letter containing relevant information. I devoutly hope such a letter will also be one more befitting shadow hunters and less bedlamites. In Raziel's name, Consul Wayland.
Chapter 8. That Fire of Fire. You call it hope, that fire of fire. It is but agony of desire.
Edgar Allan Poe. Tamerlane. Tessa sat at her vanity table, methodically brushing out her hair. The air outside was cool but humid, seeming to trap the water of the Thames scented with iron and city dirt. It was the sort of weather that made her normally thick, wavy hair tangled at the ends. Not that her mind was on her hair. It was simply a repetitive motion, the brushing, that allowed her to keep a sort of forcible calm. Over and over in her mind she saw Jem's shock as Charlotte read out Mortmain's letter, and Will's burned hands, and the tiny bit of Yim Fen she had managed to gather up off the floor. She saw Cecily's arms about Will, and Jem's anguish as he apologized to Will.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
She hadn't been able to bear it. They had been in agony, both of them, and she loved them both.
Their pain had always been because of her. She was what Mortmain wanted. She was the cause of Jem's Yin Fen being gone and Will's misery. When she had whirled and run out of the room, it had been because she could not stand it any longer. How could three people, who cared for one another so much, cause one another so much pain? She set the hairbrush down and looked at herself in the mirror. She looked tired, with shadowed eyes, as Will had looked all day as he sat with her in the library and helped Charlotte with Benedict's papers, translating some of the passages that were in Greek or Latin or Pergetic, his quill pen moving swiftly over paper, his dark head bent. It was odd to look at Will in the daylight and remember the boy who had held her as if she were a life raft in a storm on the steps of Woolsey's house. Will's daylight face was not untroubled, but it was not open or giving either. He had not been unfriendly or cold, but neither had he looked up or smiled over the library table at her, or acknowledged in any way the events of the previous night. She'd wanted to pull him aside and ask him if he had heard from Magnus, to say to him, "No one understands what you feel but me, and no one understands what I feel but you. So can we not feel together?" But if Magnus had contacted him, Will would have told her. He was honorable. They were all honorable. If they had not been, she thought, looking down at her hands, perhaps everything would not be so awful. It had been foolish to offer to go to Mortmain. She knew that now. But the thought had seized her as fiercely as a passion. She could not be the cause of all of this unhappiness and not do something to alleviate it. If she gave herself up to Mortmain, Jem would live longer, and Jem and Will would have each other, and it would be as if she had never come to the Institute. But now, in the cold hours of the evening, she knew that nothing she could do would turn back the clock or unmake the feelings that existed between them all. She felt hollow inside, as if a piece of her were missing, and yet she was paralyzed. Part of her wanted to run to Will, to see if his hands were healed and to tell him she understood. The rest of her wanted to flee across the hall to Jem's room and beg him to forgive her. They had never been angry with each other before, and she did not know how to navigate a Jem who was furious. Would he want to end their engagement? Would he be disappointed in her? Somehow that thought was as hard to bear, that Jem might be disappointed in her. Psst! She looked up and around the room, a faint noise. Perhaps she had imagined it. She was tired. Perhaps it was time to call for Sophie to help her with her dress, and then to retire to bed with a book. She was partway through the castle of Otranto, and finding an excellent distraction. She had risen from her chair and gone to ring the servant's bell, when the noise came again, more determined. A shh-psh against the door of her bedroom. With slight trepidation, she crossed the room and flung the door open. Church crouched on the other side, his blue-grey fur ruffled, his expression furious. Around his neck was tied a bow of silver lace, and attached to the bow was a small piece of roll paper in a tiny scroll. Tessa dropped to her knees, reached for the bow and untied it. The bow fell away, and the cat immediately bolted down the hall. The paper came free of the lace, and Tessa picked up the paper and unrolled it. Familiar looping script traced its way across the page. "Meet me in the music room. J."
"There's nothing here," Gabriel said.
He and Gideon were in the drawing room. It was quite dark, with the curtains drawn. If they had not had their witch lights, it would have been as black as pitch. Gabriel was going hastily through the correspondence on Charlotte's desk for the second time.
"What do you mean, nothing?" said Gideon, standing by the door. "I see a pile of letters there. Certainly one of them must be..."
"Nothing scandalous," Gabriel said, slamming a desk drawer shut.
"Or even interesting. Some correspondence with an uncle in Idris. He appears to have gout."
"Fascinating," Gideon muttered.
"One cannot help but wonder exactly what it is the Consul believes Charlotte to be involved in. Some sort of betrayal of the Council."
Gabriel picked up her sheaf of letters and made a face.
"We could reassure him of our innocence if only we knew what it was that he had suspected."
"And if I believed he wanted to be reassured of our innocence," Gideon said, "it seems more likely that he is hoping to catch her out."
He reached out a hand.
"Give me that letter. The one to our uncle."
Gabriel was dubious, but did as directed. He held the witchlight up, shining its rays over the desk as Gideon bent over, and having appropriated one of Charlotte's pens, began to scratch out a missive to the consul. Gideon was blowing on the ink to dry it when the door of the drawing room flew open. Gideon jerked upright. A yellow glow poured into the room, far brighter than the dim witchlight. Gabriel put up a hand to cover his eyes, blinking. He ought to have put on a night vision rune, he thought, but they took time to fade, and he had been concerned it would have raised questions. In the moments that it took his vision to adjust, he heard his brother exclaim aghast, "Sophie!" "I've told you not to call me that, Mr. Lightwood." Her tone was cold. Gabriel's vision resolved, and he saw the maid standing in the doorway, a lamp in one hand. She was squinting. Her eyes narrowed further as they lit on Gabriel, Charlotte's letters still in his hand. Is that Mrs. Bramwell's correspondence? Gabriel dropped the letters hastily on the desk.
Have you been reading her letters?
Sophie looked furious, like some sort of avenging angel, lamp in hand. Gabriel glanced quickly at his brother, but Gideon appeared to be struck speechless. In all Gabriel's life, he could not remember his brother giving even the prettiest of Shadow Hunter girls a second glance. Yet he looked at this scarred mundane servant as if she were the sun rising. It was inexplicable, but it was also undeniable. He could see the horror on his brother's face as Sophie's good opinion of him shattered before his eyes.
"Yes," Gabriel said. "Yes, we are indeed going through her correspondence."
Sophie took a step back.
"I shall fetch Mrs. Bramwell immediately."
"No!" Gabriel held out a hand. "It isn't what you think. Wait!" Quickly, he outlined what had happened. The consul's threats, his request that they spy on Charlotte, and their solution to the problem. "We never intended to reveal a word she had actually written," he finished. "Our intention was to protect her." Sophie's suspicious expression did not change.
"And why should I believe a word of that, Mr. Lightwood?"
Gideon finally spoke.
"Miss Collins," he said, "please. I know that since the unfortunate business with the scones, you have not held me in esteem, but please do believe I would not betray the trust Charlotte has placed in me, nor reward her kindness to me with betrayal." Sophie wavered for a moment, then dropped her gaze.
"I am sorry, Mr. Lightwood. I wish to believe you, but it is with Mrs. Bramwell that my first loyalty must lie."
Gabriel snatched up from the desk the letter his brother had just written.
"Miss Collins," he said, "please read this missive. It was what we had intended to send the consul. If, after reading it, you are still determined in your heart to seek out Mrs. Bramwell, then we will not try to stop you."
Sophie looked from him to Gideon. Then, with a quick inclination of her head, she came forward and set the lamp down on the desk. Taking the letter from Gideon, she unfolded it and read out loud.
"To Consul Josiah Wayland, from Gideon and Gabriel Lightwood. Dear Sir, you've displayed your usual great wisdom in asking us to read Mrs. Branwell's missive to Idris. We obtained a private glance into said correspondence and observed that she is in almost daily communication with her great-uncle, Roderick Fairchild. The contents of these letters, sir, would shock and disappoint you. It has robbed us of much of our belief in the fairer sex. Mrs. Bramwell displays a most callous, inhumane and unfeminine attitude towards his many grievous ills. She recommends the application of less liquor to cure his gout, shows unmistakable signs of being amused by his dire ailment of dropsy, and entirely ignores his mention of a suspicious substance building up within his ears and other orifices. Signs of the tender feminine care one would expect from a woman to her male relatives, and the respect any relatively young woman should give her elder as his due, there are none. Mrs. Bramwell, we fear, has run mad with power. She must be stopped before it is too late, and many brave shadow hunters have fallen by the wayside for lack of feminine care. Yours faithfully, Gideon and Gabriel Lightwood."
There was a silence when she had finished. Sophie stood for what felt like an eternity,
staring wide-eyed at the paper. At last, she said, "Which one of you wrote this?" Gideon cleared his throat.